is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. Yesterday was Memorial Day. I hope you and your family had a wonderful time together, and the news has not been dormant. There are always issues for us to talk about, and today we're going to be talking on the program about this great question. When does a boy become a man? And that question has been asked so many times, and we're going to have a classic discussion about that particular issue today. But first, a review of the news. It's important for us to recognize that on the issue of abortion, we've gained ground and we have lost ground. And let me be clear what I mean about that. We are gaining ground in terms of the cultural conversation. I don't have any doubt about that. The advent, for instance, of the multidimensional imaging technologies, the sonogram, the ultrasound, and all of this has given us a look into the womb that has helped us to understand that this is a human life, and helped a lot of people who had not wanted to think it through, they hadn't wanted to confront the issue, they now see the inherent humanity in the womb. Now, we've also gained ground in some other ways. For instance, the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003, and that's a very important issue. Why? Well, because a lot of Americans were newly informed and newly awakened to the fact that a late-term pregnancy is in many ways the same thing as a living human baby. It's just a matter of where the baby is, in the womb or outside the womb. What's the moral distinction there? And I think some other things actually kind of played into an awakened conscience on the issue of abortion. I think the murder of Lacey Peterson and her little baby Connor. I think this actually helped a lot of people when we recognized that was two murders, not one, even though Connor had not yet been born. We gained some ground there. We're gaining ground among young people. That's very good news. But we're losing ground in other places. We're losing ground in some court decisions. We're losing ground where courts are saying that, for instance, parental notification bills are unconstitutional because this idea that a woman, and in this case a girl, a minor girl, has an unfettered right to an abortion, a right that's found nowhere in the Constitution, is something that so many of these judges adamantly believe in. And thus we're at some kind of an impasse. The culture war on the issue of abortion continues, but it's important for us to recognize as Christians. And I'm speaking as a very clear pro-life Christian. I want to speak very clearly to the fact that I am absolutely certain that Scripture consistently would have us to understand that human life begins at the moment of fertilization. I would say the moment of conception, but people have been playing around with that word to the point that some medical practitioners now define conception as when the fertilized embryo or the fertilized egg is successfully implanted in the uterine wall. If we have at some point just made an arbitrary decision that this is when human life begins, we're in big trouble. Leon Cass, who is chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics, said just over this past weekend that there is no discernible point from fertilization until talking, at which scientists or philosophers can say at this point the person is human and at some previous point he or she is not. I thought that was a very amazing statement, and that was made on NPR's Science Friday program with Ira Flatow by Leon Cass. But we do need to know what the other side is saying. John Swamley, who is Professor Emeritus of Christian Social Ethics at the St. Paul School of Theology, writing in the rather liberal journal Christian Ethics Today, he criticized Justice Antonin Scalia of the United States Supreme Court. He criticized him for going to what is known as the Red Mass. Now, Antonin Scalia is a Roman Catholic, and the Red Mass is a Catholic Mass. What is it? It's a Mass at which government officials are invited, and the Roman Catholic Church reminds them of their responsibilities. And that's just too much for John Swamley. This is what he said. He said that of Justice Scalia, that when he goes to an event like this, he says there's an underlying assumption that law and morality began with the Roman Catholic Church and divine revelation. Well, as an evangelical Christian, let me tell you, I don't believe for a minute that the law and morality began with the Roman Catholic Church, but I do believe that they began with divine revelation. If they didn't begin with divine revelation, then where do they begin? John Swamley believes in a secular ethic, and that's very clear. But where does this secular ethic lead? In the same journal several years ago, he argued, and I'm using his words here, that abortion per se is not morally wrong, but should be left to private decision and medical judgment. Now, what I hope we see here is this worldview clash. If you believe that human life has special dignity because human beings are made in the image of God, you can only know that by divine revelation. You're not going to know that through a secular ethic. If you're going to hold to a secular ethic, then you have to arbitrarily decide, this is how I'm going to define humanity, and I can say it begins at this point and isn't present until that point. Dr. Swamley's done us a service by his candor. He said this, public policy must defend the rights of existing living persons as over against religiously based claims made on behalf of fetal life. Well, who are these existing living persons anyway? And who gets to decide how many of them are deserving of protection? After all, the Nazi doctors and the Nazi medical ethicists decided that there was life unworthy of life, and that included people far outside the womb. There were courts that decided that Terri Schiavo's life was no longer worthy of life. There are people in the Netherlands right now who are having their lives ended because in the name of suffering or terminal disease or whatever, they're just no longer worthy of life. There are obstetricians and neonatologists in the Netherlands who are euthanizing newborns outside the womb now. Not talking about abortion. These are newborns. Euthanizing them because they say they are life unworthy of life. Folks, we need to watch where this leads. I think we know where it leads. In the New York Times on May the 27th, there was an amazing story. It was headlined, Surrogate Mother's New Niche, Bearing Babies for Gay Couples. You may remember that the judge in California who threw out that state's ban on same-sex marriage, he used the bizarre argument that even though same-sex couples can't procreate, they can, and these are his words, cause procreation. I really went at that construction. What in the world does cause procreation mean? Well, in this New York Times story, cause procreation means that these gay couples arrange for a surrogate mother to bear their child. Of course, it means more than her womb. In this case, you have a woman by the name of Laura Stiller, who is a surrogate mother for a gay couple, Carrie Friedman, and his partner, Rick Welish. They're both medical doctors. And in this case, she is doing this. She brought not only her womb, but her egg. She was artificially inseminated with the sperm from one of these gay men, and thus she's about the business, and it is a business, of serving as a surrogate mother for gay couples. According to the New York Times, surrogates are paid about $20,000 above and beyond medical expenses. And the organization Parents Through Surrogacy from Gurnee, Illinois, says there are approximately 1,000 surrogate births a year. And that's an incredibly large number, actually. Now, even where homosexual couples aren't able to marry, of course, by legal arrangements, they're able to come up with this kind of surrogacy agreement. But what does it say about the women who would offer their wombs, and their eggs for that matter, in order to serve as a surrogate for homosexual couples? In all honesty, there's a bit of the rebellious nature in me, acknowledged Sharon Klein, who is one of these surrogates. She's identified as a mother of three in Cypress, California. Quote, I know that there are people who wouldn't approve of being a surrogate for gay parents, and that has made it more intriguing. And we thought she didn't have a serious moral argument. Can you believe that? She said, just because people would be against this, that made it all the more intriguing to me. Ladies and gentlemen, what this means is that there is now an industry that has arisen around the whole idea of same-sex marriage and same-sex parenting and surrogate parenting and all the rest. You wondered what the judge in California meant when he talked about causing procreation? Well, this is what it's talking about. Now, here is the reality. You don't need to know anything above biology 101 to understand this. A woman and a woman can't bear a child. A man and a man can't bear a child. They can't conceive a child. It can't happen either way. God has made us male and female. In complementarity, he has made the process of human reproduction inherently heterosexual. Now, you can try to come up with some kind of legal or technological way around that, but inevitably, here's the end result. You have to have a male cell and a female cell, and you have to have a female womb. There's no way around that. God's creation is not bending to the homosexual agenda. This is a reminder to us that the rebellion against God's order in this particular situation is so deep that it not only means that marriage is being overthrown and heterosexuality is being disregarded and rejected, but the entire process of human reproduction is being contorted through legal arrangements and technology and surrogacy and in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination and all the rest in order to go around the picture that God put in creation for all of us to see. Now, I say that not out of anger. I say that out of concern. Romans chapter 1 makes very clear that a civilization, a society, or individuals who would give themselves to this kind of self-deception, they're the very kind of people who no longer understand how to talk about sin at all. We are sinners saved by grace as Christians. It's not as if we have not sinned. But we have to speak honestly about sin because of all people, we're the people who really know what sin is all about. We know how self-deceptive it can be. We know how entrapping. We know how deceiving and deceptive it is. We're to be the people of the truth. And when you see a newspaper headline like this in the New York Times, it's a reminder to us of just how costly and complicated this business of Christian truth-telling can be in the 21st century. We've got to make sure this does not numb us into silence or intimidate us into inaction. We got to talk about what really matters and think it through from a Christian perspective, and that's what we do here every single day. Gender is really important. When does a boy become a man? That's a question we're going to answer in this next program. I'm Albert Mohler.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler program.
Today I am a man. Those are the words from the Jewish bar mitzvah ceremony, and that's very much a part of the Jewish culture, and I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that, because I don't think they mean, literally, that at age 13 or whenever the boy's bar mitzvah, he just becomes a man. I don't think he's out on his own. By and large, he's not living on his own. He's not providing for his own. He's not legally responsible for all of his own affairs. And as a matter of fact, you can go through a ceremony. That still doesn't mean you can vote or sign up and enlist in the armed forces. I'm not making light of it, though. I think there's something to the ceremony that recognizes that there is a period of life in which a boy becomes a man. But I had an interesting email from a young man. And by the way, when I got it, I didn't know how young the young man was when he sent this email to me, asking the question, when does a boy become a man? I knew there had to be something behind that question. And sure enough, there was. It was a very earnest and an intelligent question from a teenager who was just considering some of the issues in terms of the biblical order between men and women and trying to figure out how he fit into that and how family and school and church and all should take this into account. It is a tough question for us, isn't it? Because in the background of this is the invention of adolescence over the last couple of hundred years, in which we have this period in which there's this almost a man, but not yet. And, of course, there are analogies on the female side, when a girl becomes a woman. But today we're looking at the question, when does a boy become a man? And when I was asked this question, I decided I'm going to answer it. And so I set down 13 different rules or principles for determining when a boy becomes a man. I don't know if I'll add to these. I can't think I'll take any away, but this was a first shot at trying to define functionally and biblically and theologically when a boy becomes a man. Here's my argument. Number one, when he reaches the point of spiritual maturity sufficient to lead a wife and children. I think the spiritual maturity has to come first. Secondly, personal maturity sufficient to be a responsible husband and father. Economic maturity sufficient to hold an adult job and handle money. Physical maturity sufficient to work and to protect a family. Sexual maturity sufficient to marry and to fulfill God's purposes. Moral maturity sufficient to lead by example of righteousness. Ethical maturity sufficient to make responsible decisions. Worldview maturity sufficient to understand what is really important in life. Relational maturity sufficient to understand and respect others. Social maturity sufficient to make a contribution to society. Biblical maturity sufficient to lead at some level in the church. Verbal maturity sufficient to communicate and articulate as a man. And character maturity sufficient to demonstrate courage under fire. Now, as I look at that, I have to say, I'm not sure that we can put any age on that arbitrarily. As a matter of fact, I'm sure we can't. There's no particular date on the calendar where a boy reaches all of these hallmarks and then becomes a man. But somewhere in those late teen years, And I think that's where this must happen. A boy becomes a man. And then that's recognized in our college development in terms of this age between, say, 18 and 22, when most young men are in college, that's kind of an extended adolescence. But certainly by the time a young man graduates from college or reaches about that age, about age 22, he should fulfill all of these hallmarks and should be ready to take his place as a man. And if that is not the case, then something has gone wrong. We've been talking about this extension of boyhood into what should be the years of manhood. We've been looking at the delay of marriage and the fact that this is a generation that in many ways won't grow up. And I appreciated this question from a young writer who was asking this question honestly, and I really had to frame this in my own thinking in terms of what this would mean. And I'm not only looking at this as a theologian, I'm not only looking at this as someone involved in public policy, I'm looking at this as a father of a boy who just recently turned 13. And this is becoming something of an outline for my teaching and my leadership in his life as well. But I want to know from you out there, when do you think a boy becomes a man? And I want to tell you why it's really important, because it has to do with order in the church. It has to do with order in the home. It has to do with expectations of this young man. It has to do with how we prepare them to be ready to assume adult responsibility. Now, here's my theory. If a boy doesn't know what a man is, he can't know what he's supposed to be aiming for. And unfortunately, an awful lot of the men he observes aren't acting like men. And beyond that, there are more of them who can't articulate what it means to be a man. And I think if we can't articulate it, we can't teach them. Now, I'm not sure that my list is perfect. In fact, I'm sure it's not. And I know that there may be many of you out there who have something to add to this. And there are some folks giving fascinating attention to this. Doug Wilson has his book, Future Men. Robert Lewis of Little Rock has his book on raising a modern-day knight. I think there are a lot of good ideas out there. And I think a lot of Christian churches are trying to think this through, because we know there is a problem that boys are not growing up as they should into a healthy biblical manhood. And we better take the responsibility to help them, and that means to teach them, and that means to lead them. We need to live before them as men, and we need to tell them what would be required of them. But when does this happen? In other words, when should we see this happening? When does a boy become a man? How much of a factor is age? I've met some 15-year-olds who I thought were incredibly mature and showed signs of manhood, and I've met 30-year-olds who didn't. But certainly there has to be some kind of minimum age. But I'm telling you, we're in big trouble when we have this entire generation that seems so unwilling to grow up. I appreciated the letter from this young man, because I can tell he's serious. And I can tell he wants to be a man, and he wants to make sure that he knows what he is supposed to be aiming for. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Perhaps you are a father, and this has been a concern for your son. Perhaps you're a son. And perhaps you are a young man, and this has been a concern for you. Perhaps you're in a church that has formalized this in some way, either a program of study and instruction, a mentoring program, or maybe even some kind of ceremonial transition. I'd love to hear what you are thinking about. 877-893-8255. I'm going to go to Rebecca, calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN Radio. Rebecca, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, I go to a pretty large church, and I'm curious why it's a rare occasion that you see a man finally kind of reach manhood and maturity for especially Christianity until they're close to, you know, 28, 30, something like that.
Well, Rebecca,
they have to go through a lot of bad, you know, decisions before they finally kind of get it.
Yeah, well, maybe we're kind of slow learners, but Rebecca, I'd love to hear from a female perspective here, a Christian woman in a church. What are you looking for? In other words, what defines a man for you?
Somebody who's consistently making godly decisions, where it's more than about impressing people. It's more, you know, looking to God for answers, more of a heart issue than just being financially secure. Or, you know, I'm married. I've been married 10 years, but I'm an observer. I watch and I see, and that's just what I've noticed.
Yeah, well, Rebecca, I think you're noticing what a lot of people are noticing, and I think it's interesting that the first caller we have on a program about when a boy becomes a man is a woman calling to say, honestly, I'm not seeing a lot of this transition, and I think, guys, we better hear this. This is an indictment about the state of manhood in the church, and when I asked Rebecca to define it, you know, this was not her word, but she came down to leadership, a godly leadership, a man who predictably makes the right decision, sets the right priorities in terms of God's word and the challenges of everyday life. I find it encouraging that that's what a Christian woman is looking for in a Christian man. That thrills me. What do you think about this? I'd love to hear from some parents, maybe some young men. Maybe some of you in local church ministry dealing with this issue. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We don't have anything quite like a bar mitzvah. Some churches are trying to come up with some kind of analogous ceremony here. I don't know if that's the right way to go or not. Tell me what you're thinking. 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
I think America valorizes boyhood in terms of entertainment and other culture, and it penalizes young men for growing up because it really does not put a priority on all the hallmarks of maturity. If you look at the heroes in the movies, they're in many ways just not mature human beings. You look at the entertainment culture and all the rest, and then you just think about the net result in the entire culture, and you see all these young men who basically just hang around with other young guys. They're not coupling. They're not moving towards marriage. They're not assuming responsibility. Sometimes they're going from job to job, playing video games late at night, doing all the kinds of things that you might associate with high schoolers or even young college students, but not with people who ought to be out making a productive contribution to society. I think this is one of the major symptoms on our national thermometer of where we have reached a fever pitch problem. I think we're now reaching the point that the norm is becoming this delay of manhood, and I think we're reaping the social consequences of that. Let's go to Eric, listening on WTBN, calling from St. Pete, Florida. Eric, go right ahead.
How you doing? Thank you for having me on.
I'm glad to have you, Eric. Go right ahead. When does a boy become a man?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. I think that we're going to naturally become a man, and I believe that's about 18. But what is a man is the other question, and I don't know when that comes. I think that generally the ones who do become men tend to become a man about 25. I do agree with the female caller. She said it's something about 25. I think that's when we get into the groove of things, especially those who love the Lord. But I think it's a two-part. The question is, what is a man? Because we're naturally going to become men physically in the sense of, at 18 and, 21, when we can vote and get our driver's license and things of that nature.
Now, Eric, you made a fascinating statement, Eric, when you said that kind of biological manhood comes, you said, around 18. Obviously, a boy generally that has been through puberty and has reached a more or less adult size and something like adult strength, large enough to take care of himself, he can feed and clothe himself, we should hope, and do all that. But you kind of dated emotional or personality manhood about 7 or 8 years later. Now, let me ask you, Eric, don't you think we ought to be getting those closer together? I mean, to me, that sounds like a problem you've just diagnosed.
Yeah, I think it is. But I think, and not to belittle or take away from the female, but from my own observation, oftentimes the father's not there. And even if he is physically still not there, but the women have it, when their menstrual cycle, their mother's there. When they start to develop, the mother's there to say, oh, baby, this is what's going on and this is what's happening. But when we go through our things, oftentimes there's no man there. And then when we do get advice, it's foolish advice from my own experience. You do this, what makes a man? Because I know for me, my college years were painful mentally because of my question was, what is a man? And every one of my answers, it came to me in the number of women you have and other things of that nature. And then I couldn't, and thank God that I got that, because if I had found a physical man, I think I would still be messed up. But it all led me to Jesus, into what is a man. And I found that real men love Jesus. So that's, I think, I don't know what goes on, but for us, I think it's just something from my experience. I teach high school, and it's something about men don't get it till about 25, from my experience.
Well, Eric, God bless you. Your call's 14-karat gold. It was just great to hear from you, and I appreciate your Christian testimony in the midst of that, as well as your personal testimony. And yeah, I think you've diagnosed a problem, this delay of manhood. And I think, by the way, that your observation that a lot of guys just don't get it till about 25, you're about right. And I think what we have to do is help them to get it earlier, because during all those years they're not getting it, they're getting in trouble, and they're getting other people in trouble too. I'd love to know what you think about this. And I'm surprised I really haven't heard from some parents who want to make a contribution to this, or maybe from some young guy out there who says, hey, I'd kind of like to talk to you about what it's like to be on this end. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Very quickly, let's go to Melissa, listening on WTV. And Melissa, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Amen to Brother Eric. I am a parent. I have a son who's 11 and a son who's 7. I have an unbelieving husband. And I have to teach my kids the full counsel of God at home, because they're not going to get it in these watered-down churches that preach a very smooth gospel, good, you know, self-esteem gospel. No one's preaching against fornication. If they were, these kids wouldn't be waiting until they're 25 because to get married. They'd be ready at 20, believe me.
Melissa, God bless you. I wish you could come join my church because I'd love to have a mother with your conviction in it. And you're right. If the church isn't preaching it, why are we surprised when we see young men not growing up into manhood? After all, if they don't know what it is and what it's supposed to look like, how in the world are they going to aim for it? That was a great word from Melissa. I'd love to hear from you. 877-893-8255 from Louisville, Kentucky. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler Program.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you the truth. I can remember thinking about this when I was a boy. You know, what does it look like to be a man? Fortunately, I had a godly father, and he played the role of a man. He was a man. And I could see him. I could learn from him. And that was probably more important than I could ever estimate. But I never really had anyone say, here's a list. You know, here's what it looks like. And I think it's because in a day of less confusion, you probably didn't have to say so much. But in a time in this generation with so much confusion, I think you got to say more. Somehow there's this inverse formula. The more confusion, the more you got to talk. The more you got to clarify. The clearer you have to be about what really represents manhood. Remember, I said spiritual maturity, personal maturity, economic maturity, physical maturity, sexual maturity, moral maturity, ethical maturity, worldview maturity, relational, social, biblical, verbal maturity, and character. It seems to me that character is kind of a summary of all that, but of course there's more as well. I'd love to know what you think. I think this is one of those issues that we may revisit from time to time. This list may get a little longer. I can't imagine it would get any shorter. I'm going to go to Amy calling, listening on WFGQ in Iowa. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I think a lot of it, a man or a boy becoming a man, depends on accountability, too. I know a gentleman who has four kids from three women, and none of which he takes care of on his own. He lives with his mom and his father, and he has no job and is using the welfare system. So,
Five alarm fire. Just think of that list we were talking about. Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who is no man. I mean, he may be legally a man, he may be biologically a man, but if he's got three kids and not taking care of any of them, the three different women, good grief, what a meltdown here, and he's living with mom and dad, living with mommy and daddy. There you got it. Something's wrong with this picture.
Exactly. If he would have to be responsible and take, you know, control over and take responsibility over what he has done, then he would be a man.
I'm with you, Amy. Oh, you know, I wish I could say that kind of tale that Amy just told is isolated and rare, but you know it's not. It's all too common. Let's go to Jeff calling from Clearwater, Florida. Go ahead, Jeff. All right, we lost Jeff. Rod in Cleveland, Ohio. Let's end on WHK. Rod, your turn.
Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead, Rod.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. You know, my thought is that it really starts off early in life because so many of us, men and women, as fathers and mothers, have no clue what a real man looks like, so we don't know how to start targeting our child toward that. We wait till 14, 15 years old to try to start instilling these things, and it's not there. It's too late. Well, we needed to start a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
I think we need to as mothers and fathers, begin to go back and look at the examples of Job and look at what our Bible teaches us and make sure that not only are we teaching it, but that we're demonstrating it so
yeah.
that they see what it looks like as well as be told what to look for.
Rod, you're exactly right, and that's why a boy needs a dad. I mean, if there's any one just clear, quintessential explanation for that fact, it's that. A boy needs a dad because that's where he's going to see this. And if he doesn't have a dad, God bless him, those who love him and are taking care of him better get a surrogate dad there, either a grandfather or an uncle or a trusted Christian man who can show this boy what manhood is supposed to look like. Because you can describe it all you want. You can talk about it and define it. You can line it out and read about it. But if you don't see it, it's almost impossible to understand. I think that's really important. Let's go to Sean, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Sean.
Hello, Dr. Mohler. Thank you for taking my call. in talking about this list, one thing that's just on my mind and heart, and being in the church and being a pastor of the church, is this whole idea of men realizing their biblical responsibility, fulfilling that role that Scripture has called them to. We've got fathers who are in the home, but they really aren't fathering according to that scriptural model and investing time, especially in their boys, to help them understand what a biblical man is.
Yeah, well, I think you are exactly right. And I think we're reaping the harvest of a generation that hasn't seen it, hasn't been taught it. And that's why just having a man in the home isn't enough if he's not showing what manhood's supposed to look like, don't you think?
Absolutely. I agree. You know, I have two young sons, and they're still very young. I'm not really to that point of being able to invest in them scripturally. They're 2 years and 2 months. But I'm very mindful of this huge responsibility that I have to model godliness before them, not just to be a father in the secular sense of providing for their physical needs, but of putting before them an example of godliness. And that is just so missing in the church, and it's what I try to hit home to the fathers in my congregation all the time.
God bless you, Sean. You know, a dad shows a boy how to play like a man, how to laugh like a man, how to think like a man, how to stand up like a man, how to lead like a man. You know, it's so interesting if you just see something like this. I was watching something the other day. I saw a picture of a father wolf, and he had his mouth open, and he was howling. And beside him was this little tiny pup wolf with his mouth open, trying to be just like daddy. Now, if a wolf is like that, just imagine a human boy made in the image of God, trying to figure out what he's supposed to grow up and be like. You know, let's just pray that there's a daddy right there to show him what that looks like. What a high calling that is. Don't I know it? I've got a son myself. Thanks for your call, Sean. Let's go to Cameron calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Go ahead, Cameron.
How you doing, Mr. Albert Mueller?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you there in Dubuque.
Yeah, see, I think I have to go along with Paul on this one, and I think it's where he says, when I was a child, I did childish things. But
yeah,
when I became a man, I put away childish things, and I did things like a man. So I think when you can clearly see that, you know, a person is not doing childish things, then he's winning the manhood.
Okay, Cameron, I'm with you. When do you think that should come? Let me ask you for a chronology here. When would you be worried if you didn't see that in a guy?
Well, I don't know. I'm just going by looking at his actions and the decisions
yeah.
he makes and.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think that's exactly what the Apostle Paul's talking about. Of course, he's talking about spiritual maturity there, and he's talking about the maturity to put away childish things, and it is a great model. When I was a boy, a child acted like a child. I thought as a child. I spoke as a child, but no longer. A man has to put away those childish things. Now boys never, they never grow up to not have fun. That's another thing. We as dads need to show our boys, and that is how a man has fun. I mean, a man has to be serious, but a man also has joy in his life. The joy of fulfilling his responsibility, the joy of his wife and his children, the joy of his calling, and the joy of his leadership. And yeah, the joy sometimes of just having fun in a God-pleasing way. You know, that's something that's really important. Just think about what it was like if you are a man, what it was like to be a boy. And you know that you look back at that as some real golden time. But most of us wouldn't want to go back there. I mean, we're glad we grew up to be a man. I am thankful that someone showed me how to get there. Who's going to show your sons, if not you? That's what we'll talk about when we come back with some final thoughts. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Well, you know, I find this a fascinating question because I work with an awful lot of young men. And I want to say, they are, by and large, an incredible group. You know, at our college and seminary, I get to see all these young guys who are going to be the leaders of the future. And by and large, the fact that they are here indicates they're the winners in this. They're the guys who understood manhood and are aiming for it. But I get some fascinating questions here almost every week, some question. And I get it in the local church, too. And I was in a local church not too long ago where there were a lot of homeschoolers. And I'm very, very supportive, as you know, the homeschool movement. But I had the question, you know, when should a teenage boy be taught primarily by men rather than by women? One of the challenges for homeschoolers is to figure out how to educate, especially older boys, in a way that honors their growing manhood. and understands the fact that a man needs to take the lead. A man needs to be there to provide that instruction. If not the actual every hour of instruction, then at least the overall direct supervision of the entire process and the direct supervision of the boy's character formation and growth into maturity. I get other questions in the local church. What about teachers in the youth ministry, in the youth program? How old should boys be being taught by men and women, understanding the biblical pattern of complementarity? You know, these questions only matter to people who want to really be faithful to Scripture. If you don't care about it, you're not going to worry about it. And if you're not going to worry about it, well, you're probably not concerned about when boys become men either. But it is a big question. It's a responsible question for Christians to ask. And it's another wake-up call that we as parents and as Christian leaders, but let me say, first of all, as parents, we have to say this is our responsibility. And, of course, there's an analogous responsibility on the part of young women, but I just want to tell you, I think they're doing better than the young men. I think that girls are growing up to be women in a more natural way than boys are growing up to be men. I think the role models are broken. I think that boys are left to parent themselves. I think there's a lack of discipline. Yes, a lack of discipline. There's a lack of teaching. I think parents are sometimes just backing off of their boys way too early. And I think there are just a lot of lazy men out there who aren't showing up to do the hard work of showing their boys what it is to be a man. And putting some teeth to the definition. That's why I've offered my definition. On Thursday and Friday of this week, I'm going to have up a commentary at the site albertmuller.com that'll really deal with this and put it out in writing. That way you can look at it and you see if you agree with it. Maybe you want to add something to my list of criteria here. But let's think about it. And let's put our best Christian thinking to the workplace here of our own space of living, our own family, our own church, our own congregation, our own place of service. Because if we're not thinking about this, no one's going to think about it. You know, the Jewish tradition does have the bar mitzvah. We don't have anything quite like it. But there needs to be some way that a boy knows what it is to become a man and has some assurance from his peers, the men of the church, the men of his family, that he's getting there. We'll be back tomorrow. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation about the things that matter. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mohler's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.